secularism has come to mean public life without God. And that's where we get all these language rules about not talking about God in the public square, and they are aggressively pushing their preferences all the while, arguing we're not a team on the field, we're just the umpires. But it's ridiculous. I mean, they are the member of a team on the field simultaneously trying to call balls and strikes.
On this edition of the White Horse Inn, we'll be talking with Hunter Baker about his new book, The End of Secularism. The White Horse Inn, know what you believe and why you believe it.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition of the early reformers, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. We are winding up, believe it or not, our year-long theme, Christ in a Post-Christian Culture. And to help us wrap up this discussion, we have on the line Dr. Hunter Baker, who is a professor of political science and the author of the new book, The End of Secularism. Hunter, thanks for being with us on the White Horse Inn.
Sure, thanks.
I can tell that you have a good sense of humor, right?
I hope so.
So if we ask you, this would be so typical of the White Horse Inn, people would be disappointed if we didn't ask, knowing what the White Horse Inn is like. Can you help us out a little here? We've heard of hunter-gatherer, but can you tell us first what exactly Hunter Baker does?
Well, you know what? It's worse than that because two reasons. Because I have my PhD and because I've been to law school, you could say Dr. Hunter Baker, lawyer.
Oh, wow. That is really amazing. Well, I'll tell you what else is amazing is this book, The End of Secularism, by Hunter Baker. This is published by Crossway, hot off the press. Hunter Baker serves on the political science faculty at Houston Baptist University. You've written for a lot of publications, the American Spectator, National Review Online, Christianity Today, and the Journal of Law and Religion. The title of your book is The End of Secularism. So right off the bat, can you tell us what you mean by that title?
Sure. People tend to think that I'm making some kind of prediction about absolute numbers of secularists or something like that. That's not really it. The book could have just as easily been named The Failure of Secularism or The Unreasonableness of Secularism. Basically, what I'm saying is the title has a double meaning. One is The End of Secularism could be subtitled as a neutral or default position. Because I think that what I'm doing is I'm making a very strong case that secularism is not going to be some kind of historical endpoint for us, that it's not going to solve the problems of religious difference. It has too many defects to do that. And it's also titled The End of Secularism because it's about the purpose of secularism. And the purpose that secularists have.
You mention yourself in the book your debt to Richard John Neuhaus, especially
yes.
His book, The Naked Public Square. Could you put us in the context of that book and what a watershed it was and how your book continues that conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. The Naked Public Square, well, first of all, it's just that fabulous title, you know, the... Out of all the book titles, that's one of the greatest that there has ever been. But basically, he most eloquently gave voice to the feeling that religion, particularly the Christian faith, was being kind of, you know, through the 60s and 70s in particular, was being sort of systematically pushed out of the public square. And he was giving voice to basically what he felt was the resentment of average, everyday Americans. That this was happening. You know, it was something that they had not been consulted about. It was something they did not agree with. And he took it upon himself to kind of give voice to their concerns in the most articulate way possible. And he gained a lot of attention with that book, and it really helped spur the conversation. What I have tried to do is, you know, that after Neuhaus, you know, the magazine First Things came up, and there's a historian at the University of Florida named C. John Somerville, who is in that orbit of First Things contributors, and he said, you know, we have all these religion scholars. We have all these people who critically study religion. We have religion departments, but where are the scholars of secularism? You know, where are the people who study secularists and secularism and kind of try to deconstruct that? And I took it upon myself to be sort of a scholar of secularism.
Interesting. So, in other words, take the mask off and show that secularism is itself a religion of sorts.
Well, you know, I'll put it even more simply than that. I had a friend who was a missionary to Russia shortly after the fall of the Iron Curtain, and then to France. So two fairly skeptical societies. And I asked him how he could do that work. I thought it would be very difficult. And he said, you know, I found something that really makes it quite easy. Instead of starting out by telling people what I believe, I ask them to tell me what they believe. And then I just act really skeptical about it.
Nice.
And then when they try to convince me of it, they see how weak their position really is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to do with secularism here. I'm kind of trying to just present it, you know. I mean, even... what would its advocates say for it, and does that hold up? And I think that what I demonstrate in this book is that it doesn't hold up.
How would you define secularism, for instance, as distinguished from secularity or, you know, a secular kind of culture?
Sure. You know, there is a much older and better use of the term secular, which was, it's merely something that happens in the world. Right? You know, something happens in the world as opposed to, say, in heaven. And so, you know, the Catholic Church would even have secular clergy, right, as opposed to a cloistered nun, you know, who might purely be caught up in contemplation and shut away from the world. So that's a pretty valuable use of the word secular, something that happens in the world. But what it has come to mean, what secularism has come to mean, is public life without God. They would present it as we virtuously choose not to talk about God so that we may concentrate on the things we have in common. The idea is that this is going to solve the problem of religious difference. And then there's sort of an attached idea that secularism is really the mature position anyway, that we are evolving as human beings past the need to talk about religion, and that, you know, we will eventually be kind of these highly rational secular men and women.
So as Christians, we would affirm the secular as, for instance, the worldly callings that people are called to.
Absolutely.
The church should not run government and that sort of thing. But secularism is a religious point of view that says basically this world is all there is. There is nothing transcendent beyond our own wishes and ambitions.
Or their position that there's just no need to talk about that. But you know, since you guys are the White Horse Inn, I like to point to Luther, because I think that Luther is the guy who really gets this right. You know, before Luther, there's all this argument between is the king over the pope, or is the pope over the king? You know, it's kind of like there's this straight line relationship. There's God, then there's king or the pope, or God, pope, king, like that. And Luther is very clear that, you know, the church has a mission, and it reports to God for that mission, and the state has a mission, and it reports to God for that mission. So neither of them report to each other, the church or the state. But what this does not mean is that there's some kind of wall between the two, because Luther is very clear that the church has the mission to continue to call the state to righteousness, call the state to do what it's supposed to do, you know, call the state to righteousness, call the state to restrain evil men. Do not kind of be pietistically separate from the state.
But doesn't have any coercive power to get the state to do
That's correct. You know, he doesn't want to see souls ruled by steel.
You interact in your book with sociologist Peter Berger, and I'd like you to interact with a clip we have from an interview we recently recorded with Dr. Berger.
Okay.
No, I don't think we live in a post-Christian era at all. Certainly not in the United States, but actually not in most of the world. And it is Christianity that is growing enormously in much of the world. So since I changed my mind, which is a long time ago, the obvious mistake of secularization theory has become all the more clear.
Could you describe that in terms that maybe listeners not familiar with your work, could you describe for them a little bit what that secularization thesis is, and maybe a couple of reasons why you think it's wrong?
Well, the secularization thesis, basically it says the more modern a society is, the less religious it will be. Some people welcome this. I mean, that was certainly the belief of the Enlightenment in Europe. As reason and science progress, superstition, which they identified with religion, will decline. That has not happened at all. With two exceptions, one could go into in great detail. One is geographical. Western and Central Europe are indeed quite secularized societies. Very interesting question why that is so. And the other one is sociological. There is a kind of international cultural elite which is quite secular. Again, an interesting exception. But most of the world is as religious as it has ever been, and arguably even more so.
Hunter, what do you think about the transition that Peter Berger himself went through as a formative sociologist, shifting from that widely held secularization thesis to saying, hey, as a sociologist, you can't hold that anymore?
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, he was one of the big secularization theorists. I quote him in the book, something he wrote, I guess, around 1970, where he imagined that the onset of the 21st century would find just tiny groups of believers huddled together against the modern age. You know, obviously this is a this is a failed prophecy. He had the intellectual honesty to sort of go where the evidence was leading. What is really interesting is, you know, he does mention Western Europe, and Western Europe surely is probably the most secularized part of the world that I can think about. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the relationship between the church and state. You know, the Reformation church is, of course, very, very full of fire, you know, and sort of challenging the state and standing up for righteousness no matter what. But over time, just in kind of the logic of establishment, you get a more bureaucratic church, you get a more subservient church. And I think that the church just kind of became identified with the establishment in Europe, and that people ceased to respect it. And I talk about Sweden. Sweden, of course, is a terrific example of this. In Sweden, I would argue that, you know, they stopped having a church, they started having a Department of God.
Right.
And, you know, who's interested in the Department of God?
So the churches of the Reformation became sort of lackeys of the state, and then pietism went inward for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
You write, private religion is at the heart of secularism. How is that the case?
Because people who are pietists, and when I say pietists, I'm talking about people who believe in a very private religion. They're very serious about their beliefs, but it does not really come out of the building, you know, or their home. They do not tend to bring that out into the public square. Pietists tend to make that strict separation.
How does that relate to secularization, not only in terms of one's worldview and political views, but in terms of reducing the sphere of one's, the significance at least, of one's religious convictions to the inner heart,
right,
rather than this is what we believe God has done in history and what human beings are, not just what
right.
He has meant in my life? What effect does that have?
Yeah, it buys into the logic of secularism. See, secularists would be perfectly fine with people being very religious as long as that meant that their religion was private. That's fine with them. What they want is a public square where we are not talking about religion because they think it's irrelevant or even embarrassing or, you know, positively dangerous, as they sometimes seem to argue. You know, they plead us to stick to secular understandings because they're afraid we'll all turn into the Taliban. The problem with that is, I think about Baylor University when I was there. You know, we had this big battle over the presidency of Robert Sloan, and the big struggle was between, I think, pietists and those who have a more robust understanding of how your faith applies to every part of life. And the pietists would be very worried about arguing that the instruction of the classroom should connect the Christian faith to the subject matter. You know, they wanted us to have Bible studies on campus. They wanted us to have worship. But when you started to talk about bringing it into the intellectual activity of the university, that made them very unhappy.
Yep. We gave
and that's how secularists feel.
It's okay if you give your heart to Jesus as long as you give your mind to Kant.
Yeah, there you go.
That's nice. That's nice.
You're listening to White Horse Inn, and we're talking about secularism with our special guest, Dr. Hunter Baker, back in a minute. Hey, folks, Michael Horton here. Have you considered supporting our efforts here at the White Horse Inn? For your tax purposes and ours, December 31st, of course, is the big day. So as our way of saying thank you for a gift of $100 or more by December 31st, we'll send you our Celebrating 20 Years MP3 CD featuring 20 of our best programs ever from across the years, plus extensive bonus material including the pilot episode of the White Horse Inn, our famous debate with Dr. Robert Schuller, the Dad Rod Christmas special, which is my personal favorite, spoof commercials, and much, much more. Just send us your tax-deductible gift by December 31st, 2009 for that year-end deadline. For more information, visit our website, whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.
Would you go to a surgeon who earned his degree online? Would you trust your case to an online lawyer? Of course not. Is ministry any less important than surgery or the law? No, it's more important. At Westminster Seminary, California, we think that face-to-face education with qualified, experienced faculty is essential. Westminster Seminary, California, 888-480-8474 or wscal.edu. Westminster Seminary, California. For Christ, His gospel, and His church.
Welcome back to White Horse Inn, and we're talking with Dr. Hunter Baker, author of The End of Secularism. You write that, quote, the reality is that secularism doesn't provide a neutral space. Rather, it's one of many conceptual players attempting to influence social and political activity. Secularism represents a partisan position, not a neutral one. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, I tend to think that they believe themselves to be the neutral position, and around them, you know, the rest of us are orbiting, you know, with our various religious understandings. But the reality is that they do have a worldview. They are an identifiable demographic group of people. They do have preferences. And, you know, I tend to think that they are basically trying to impose their preferences on the rest of us. And that's where we get all these language rules about not talking about God in the public square. And basically, in my mind, they are aggressively pushing their preferences, all the while arguing, you know, we're not a team on the field, we're just the umpires. But it's ridiculous. I mean, they are the member of a team on the field simultaneously trying to call balls and strikes.
So you're not saying basically we should shut them down. What you're saying is let's sit around the table and at least acknowledge that you're sitting around the table too. And that
that's exactly right.
Let's exchange arguments.
That's exactly right. There's a law professor at University of Texas, Sanford Levinson, and he was just kind of bewildered at this whole idea of trying to limit what people can say in the public square, because he said, you know, we already have a limit on what you bring to the public square, and that is persuasion. You know, that's a very natural and organic limit. You know, if you can persuade people of something, then, it, you know, one imagines you're going to have some civility and some integrity to do so. And if you can't, then that will also kind of keep you from bringing something too extreme or outrageous. But, you know, by all means, go ahead and come forward, take your shot. You know, that's what the public square is for.
I had an opportunity a number of years ago to spend some time with Richard Rorty, who, of course, has had a big impact on this whole argument of keep religious justifications outside of the public square.
Yes.
And I asked him at one point, because he had defined religion as, in a perfectly Kantian way, basically what you do on your own time in your own inner experience.
Yes.
And it's people's subjective feelings. And that's okay. People can have their subjective feelings, but just don't base arguments, public arguments, on your subjective feelings. I said, what if Christianity was not about subjective feelings, whatever the other religions justified their positions on, what if we make a public claim, not even, you know, for the moment, bracketing the question of whether those claims are valid, but we are offering a testimony to something that happened in datable events in the past, you know, arguing for those positions in a very public sort of way. He says, you mean in a way where it was publicly accessible to people other than to people who already believe them?
Yes.
I said, yes, exactly. And he said, well, that would be a different kettle of fish. Do you think that the fact that we have turned Christianity into such a private, sentimental, individualistic experience rather than a witness to public truth has contributed to the caricature that secularists have of people in the public square who claim to be religious?
Yeah, well, I cannot tell you how pleased I am to hear you put it the way you put it, because I think you're exactly right. You know, and I have said as much in almost every interview, and sometimes I'm just kind of met with silence. But the fact is, the Christian faith is not, I mean, religion is not some commodity where all religions are the same. They're all about some kind of subjective, squirmy-wormy stuff. The Christian faith is different. It is unique, and it is not one of these religions where it's just based on, well, some guy goes off somewhere by himself and has a private revelation and then brings it to a bunch of other people who sort of credulously follow it. The Christian faith is based upon, as you say, an historical claim. Something happened, right? You know, this man, Jesus, who lives in history, who is executed, you know, at the hands of the Roman Empire and the Jewish authorities, that he, you know, having made these claims about being the Son of God, that he is resurrected. And if that happens, you know, and Paul says something like over 500 people can attest to this, if this happens, that means you have to reconsider everything around this man Jesus. If he's been resurrected, if this has happened and people have seen it and they've attested to it, then that means something. And then we can argue over that, right? But we're not just arguing over, I feel this, I think that. You know, we're talking about whether or not something really happened, and if it did, what does that mean? And, of course, if it did happen, then that's like the Big Bang. I mean, the noise of it is still just echoing through the universe, changing history, right?
Wow,
you know,
nice.
This is a huge event.
Yeah. Right. Well, how then, if Christians make that public claim to truth, how can we simultaneously make that public claim to truth and say, as Paul did in Athens, therefore God has put up with nonsense long enough, there's a judgment day coming, everyone must repent and believe, and yet at the same time not require the state to officially endorse Christianity?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, let me say, first of all, I wish I could make everybody in the church listen to your show, because I because I want that point of view that you put out there about the reality of the resurrection, the historic meaning, to be grasped by everyone. Because the fact is, there are way too many people in the church who just kind of participate in the church on an emotional level. You know, I mean, Christianity sort of works for them, right? You know, it's sort of like a therapeutic device for them. It helps them to deal with the world. But, you know, you and I both know that if that's what your faith is really about, you don't really have the Christian faith. Because the Christian faith is rooted in ideas about the ultimate nature of reality. Now, is there some need for us to conquer the state or to kind of force everybody in? You know, I think that goes against the very nature of the Christian faith. I agree with Martin Luther that souls are not ruled by steel, that the church's goal, the church's role in history is to reach out, to persuade, to mentor, but it's not to force people.
You have a chapter titled Secularism, A Failed Strategy for Social Peace. Why do you believe secularism is a failed strategy for peace?
Yeah, I think it's a failure because it represents the preferences of a particular group. As we were talking about earlier, there's been some wonderful studies done by a couple of political scientists. They are able to demonstrate, you know, when we talk about elections, the media is always very concerned about the religious right. What is the religious right doing? You know, what is the Republican Party doing to keep the religious right happy? And these two political scientists demonstrate fairly conclusively that there's an identifiable group of secularists just like there is the religious right, and yet the media has no interest in them whatsoever. But it is a particular group, and if they keep saying, well, things need to be the way we want it because that's what's most fair to everyone, that's transparently not true. And the larger the American government is, the more things that it does, if it is at the same time supposed to be secular, then that means that we continue to push the faith out. You know, we continue to marginalize and minimize the influence of the faith, all under this idea of a supposedly benevolent secularism.
So if genuine political neutrality is the goal, then you can't have a government that wants to manage every detail of our lives, private and public.
Exactly. You know, all the big church and state cases really happen after the New Deal. You know, when the American government is relatively small, we don't really have that many church and state legal cases because the government just didn't do that much.
Interesting. You also deal with the legendary nature of the warfare between faith and science. There's a lot there, but can you just give us some examples of that?
Yeah, well, the way it is always presented is that Christianity has somehow suppressed the growth of science in the Western world. And that's a ridiculous case to make because, as Rodney Stark has pointed out, true science, not something like alchemy or some kind of semi-mysterious activity, science arose in Europe and nowhere else. Nowhere else in the world. True science. And, of course, what kind of Europe was it? This is the Europe of Christendom. You know, and not only that, but some of the best historians of science have demonstrated that the church was actually a great benefactor, that without the church occasionally being a patron of the sciences, that they would not have grown the way they did. So it's sort of silly to, it's not only silly, I would argue that it's actually malicious, and it's a rhetorical strategy that the other side tries to make the church into an enemy of science. And the main reason to do that is not because you're afraid the church is going to put an end to science. It's because you want people to disagree with the church. I mean, because we all know science is good. We all want scientific knowledge. You know, if we can have it, we want it. About the weather, about how to lose weight, about anything. You know, we want that scientific knowledge. And so the idea is, if you are a Christian, and if that means that you have some antagonism to science, well, then you're not a person to be trusted. You're unstable. You're unreasonable.
Do you think that sometimes secularists and Christian conservatives mirror each other in terms of sort of demonizing the opponent? And are you calling for something more like, hey, let's recognize that we have fundamentally different worldviews and talk about them and argue our positions, and neither side pretend that they are just neutral, but let's offer arguments and exchange public conversation about them?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, let the arguments meet. You know, so often, and particularly because of the type of media environment we live in now, so often what we do is we want to argue, well, you know, don't listen to that person because they're part of a certain group. That's not a valid way of arguing. That achieves nothing. So what if the person offering an argument is a fundamentalist Christian? Is the argument any good or is it not? You know, that's the question. I think that was part of why Francis Schaeffer was so great, because he insisted on real communication. Does the substance of what I'm saying come into contact with the substance of what you're saying? And then maybe we'll find out the truth about something.
Not shrouded in the pretension of neutrality.
That's right. That's right.
So what do you think the future holds here with this, you know, what comes after the end of secularism?
I think that what happens is that secularism loses its luster as a solution to the problem of religious difference, that it becomes increasingly recognized as a partisan position, and I think that absolutely will happen, is happening. You know, I think that part of the reason the U.S. Supreme Court made some of the decisions it did in the late 20th century is because it saw secularism as some kind of a peaceful oasis in this storm of religious difference, but I think that it is increasingly being realized by almost everyone that it is not, in fact, that oasis, that it is merely part of the storm, and it does not create more peace. And it does not deserve this claim to being kind of a super rational position that rules all the others. And so I believe that we will eventually arrive at a more honest pluralism, which is actually an environment in which the Christian faith thrives.
Yeah, that's encouraging.
When I was in graduate school, I had a friend who was a very liberal Lutheran, and he was quite happy with the deliverances of secularism. So we would argue from time to time. We're friendly. And I said to him, well, you know, look at Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham jail. Because in the letter, he appeals directly to Augustine and to Aquinas. This is not a secular document. You know, there is Christian reasoning shot through this document that we all love and adore and revere. What do you say about that? Now, you know, I really kind of felt like I had him, right? And he says, well, he wouldn't have had to do that if he had had access at the time to a higher Marxian critique.
Wow.
And the question I would ask to everyone is, do you think that Martin Luther King wielding a higher Marxian critique would have been able to campaign so effectively against segregation?
Well, not only that, it doesn't take very good account of his biography, since he had a PhD that incorporated studying Karl Marx's direct writings as primary sources. He was a scholar
that's
in that field.
Too. That's true, too. That's true, too. And he chose not to go with the manifesto.
Wow. That is a fascinating story. So he couldn't, according to Rorty's criterion, or John Rawls' criteria, he couldn't...
He's an offender.
Yeah.
Well, and look, Rorty, you brought up Rorty. This is a guy who a few years ago openly admitted that he's a free rider on Christian values that have emerged through Western culture and civilization. Basically, these guys want to take for granted things like liberty and equality that have emerged as a consequence of the Christian faith acting in history, and particularly coming out of the Reformation. They want to just sort of take those things for granted. But the fact is that Elton Trueblood was right when he talked about the idea of cut flower civilization. You know, if you cut a flower and put it in a vase, it looks pretty for a few days, but eventually it rots, and that's because it has been cut off from its source. And that's what secularism does. It cuts off our values from their source.
Well, very helpful stuff. Hunter, thank you so much for being with us on the White Horse Inn.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
So, guys, what do you think about what we were just hearing from Hunter Baker?
Well, I'm with Rod. The stress on a public declaration that Christianity is a truth claim. Mm-hmm. Aside from whether that claim is true or not, just getting that on the table changes the game.
Because religion, if it arises from our own feelings,
yeah,
not that it doesn't affect our feelings, but if it comes from our own subjective hunches or opinions or feelings or ideas, then of course it's not something that we can base anything on.
Sure.
As far as our views of what human beings are, we could talk about maybe how it affects our personal feelings as a human being, but not what human beings are objectively.
I appreciated him bringing out that the goal is to marginalize that, but it takes a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of the gospel claim to do it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, and I certainly appreciated his references to both Luther and Calvin in separating the two, the church from the government and so forth. He was leading us up to the discussion of the two kingdoms.
Yes,
didn't quite get there, but it was on the road.
But he was certainly headed in that direction, and I think that's a helpful distinction to make when talking about Christians engaging the culture, even at the government level, because if you don't make those distinctions, you're eventually going to sound much like the religious right, which is a failed experiment in and of itself.
But we do. One of the things that he raised, and it's a good point for us to do it here, I've heard a lot of criticisms of the quote-unquote two kingdoms doctrine and, you know, what we say on this program about it. Hey, look, you're basically surrendering the public sphere to the secularists.
Not true.
It's not true at all.
Well, and I think that's where he was very strong in making that point. No, you're not surrendering to the secularists because you are actually engaging, and you're engaging on the right issues.
We're not Anabaptists.
No, and you're saying, look, secularists have a political right to practice their religion.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they also have a political right to vote in a way that they believe is most consistent with their most deeply held metaphysical mm-hmm. or anti-metaphysical beliefs.
Absolutely.
And so do Christians.
Exactly.
And in that public square, we can attempt to persuade them that our view is, in fact, correct.
Uh-huh.
But I guess this is where I guess the concern comes in, because absolutely, and I think he makes the point that our religion, our Christianity, will influence how we view the issues. The issue that I'm more concerned about, and he didn't, I'm not saying this is what he did, but those who would say, therefore, on each and every political issue, there is a Christian
right.
and a
sure.
non-Christian
right.
vote or
sure.
a way to vote. That's
right.
where it becomes dangerous. That was the problem with religious rights.
Yeah, the historic Christianity is not a PAC.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not a political party, and that's your point, right?
Yeah.
yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that's helpful to for example, the Bible has a very comprehensive understanding of what it means to be pro-life.
Uh-huh.
From the Imago Dei out uh-huh. to all kinds of ramifications about aliens and strangers and poor and the unborn, all of that stuff. What the political parties do is they'll take a slice of that comprehensive view and make the slice the whole
yep.
and use it as a wedge issue on another political mm-hmm. side. So yep. the Christian view will be much more comprehensive than either the right or the left, and it's difficult for a Christian to reduce a biblical
sure.
pro-life view to a political position.
Because sure. politics is the region of negotiation.
Yeah. yeah.
Advise
yeah.
and consent.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to give up owning the field. You're negotiating here. Basically, if you get a group of, not just Christians, a group of Americans in a room of all kinds of different persuasions, you could agree on a whole list of values. But what separates Christians, or what separates citizens, I think, is, first of all, how to rank those values. Like, what is more important,
mm-hmm. yeah.
freedom or responsibility?
Mm-hmm.
What is more important, that people have choice or that people have life?
Right.
Everyone can agree on a list of rights and responsibilities and things that we should be as a culture, and yet have very different views about, first of all, how to rank these things. Right. And then secondly, even if you agree on how to rank them, how best to fulfill
to implement.
Yeah. those yeah. rights yeah. and yeah. responsibilities.
He is the first critic I've heard talk about, even though it wasn't for very long. We didn't argue about these things when the state was smaller.
Yeah.
Mm,
yeah.
yeah.
That's a huge
point. I haven't heard anybody
yeah.
else do that.
Yeah.
Well, but when there's this gigantic pot
yeah.
of money,
yeah.
then everybody gets engaged to get their fair share.
Yeah.
Well, we have complained and lamented the church losing its gospel mission, but it's also lost its diaconal mission.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, we're closing out this year's theme, really, in this program, Christ in a Post-Christian Culture. And this discussion has helped us bring it to a close by really reminding us that although politics is very important, because for one thing, we want to have a playing field where everybody has access to the public square. We are up against a kind of vicious secularism that does want to be the state religion and is perfectly happy as the arbiter of values, perfectly happy to have 1,000 religions bloom in the empire, as long as the civil religion of secularism is respected. By the way, folks, if you want to hear that whole interview with sociologist Peter Berger, just head to our website at whitehorsein.org. Also, if you want to get Hunter Baker's book, The End of Secularism, you can also go to our website, whitehorsein.org. And folks, you know, the good news in all of this is that Jesus Christ promised, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. He is the one who has been raised, and therefore we are sent into the world to preach the gospel, making disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and teaching all of the people whom he brings into his fold everything that he has commanded. And he says, 'Lo, I am with you to the end of the age, and the gates of hell will not prevail against this church.' So there's no time for triumphalism or for despair, because Jesus Christ is Lord. Look forward to being with you again next time on the White Horse Inn.